Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. And it's thanks to Alex Lowmaster for this episode. He tipped me off to a museum local to him in Pennsylvania that were restoring a P-61 Black Widow night fighter. So joining me today is Russell Strine from the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum. But just before we get to that, I'd like to say a thank you to all the patrons of the show and to Chris Lockhart, who has signed up at the Rockefeller level on Patreon. Your patronage really helps me to find the time to put the podcast together. I do it for free and almost never carry adverts. Indeed, it would be great to be at a level where I didn't even have to consider running advertisements. So if you'd like to keep the show on the road, you can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcast or click on donate on the website. A dollar or so each month from every one of you really adds up. If you want more World War II, patrons do get access to extra episodes of the podcast as a way of me saying thank you. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast or click on donate on the website. On to the main feature. Russell, thanks for joining me. I'm sure there are many people listening who aren't aware of the P-61, but it's a fairly distinctive looking plane. Can you describe it?
The P-61, probably the most distinctive feature about it is that it was painted all black. It has twin tails and twin booms like a P-38 has. It's got two R-2800 radial engines, Pratt & Whitney radial engines, four-bladed propellers, and it operated with either a crew of two or of three. It was a single-pilot airplane. Behind him in an elevated canopy was a gunner, if the airplane actually carried a gunner. Some of the early ones had turrets, and then the mid-production, they didn't have gun turrets on them anymore. And then the later ones did have gun turrets. So the compartment is there, whether it carried a person in it or not, depended on whether it had a turret. And then in the back of it, between the two tail booms, was a compartment which was the radio operator's compartment. He operated the radar, and he was instrumental in guiding the pilot to within 5 miles of his target. And once it was in within about 5 miles, then the pilot could see a target on his radar scope and go in and close in for the kill. So it's a big airplane. It's the largest U.S. fighter ever produced. In practical terms, it's got the same wingspan as a B-25 bomber, and its length is 2 foot shorter than a B-25. Uses a lot of B-25 type systems, the hydraulic system and the components, the wheels, brakes, the tires. Everything is B-25. In fact, the landing gear itself is even B-25. It's just that it's turned around backwards.
I hadn't realized that, because I was going to say the development started after the RAF had approached the U.S., I think, for a night fighter, hadn't they?
That's correct, yes. We live in Berks County, Pennsylvania, and Boyertown, just 20 miles down the road from us, was the birthplace of General Carl Spatz. And Spatz was in charge of the Army Air Forces early on in the war. And between talking with officials in your country and him seeing the need, he kind of sketched out the specifications for a night fighter around 1940 and came back to the U.S. and presented it. The P-61 is the result. It was the first purpose-built night fighter of the war.
What amazed me was how quick he came back with the specification, how quick it went into production, which I guess if they're reusing a lot of other components, that would help. But the turnaround time was remarkable in a couple of years. Not even that, I don't think.
Yeah, most of the contract serial numbers were 1942. Our airplane is a 1942 serial number, but because of the way they assign serial numbers and the lag in production, it was not produced until August of 44.
It's still a remarkably fast turnaround. And the radar, where does the radar, what's the story with the radar? Was it an American-built unit or was it a British? When I was reading up on it, I never quite got to the bottom of the radar, whether it was a British radar and an American plane, or we gave the plans to you guys and off it went on its own, or was it specifically designed for the plane?
So you guys in England, I believe, developed the radar. Then it was turned over to researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology up in Boston, Massachusetts. And they modified it and I think perfected it even more for aircraft use. And then it was built by, in conjunction with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Western Electric built the radar and its components. We do have a radar unit and all the components, which is in the airplane at this point in time. It's a nightmare of, you know, a little box here, a big box there, another little box. It's just amazing how they came up with this back in those days. It only had a range of about 5 miles. And so the ground radar people who had, you know, larger radar sets, they would talk to the radio operator in the airplane, and they would vector him to within about 5 miles of the target. And from there, then, the pilot could see it on his radar scope, and his radar operator would direct him to the target. And it's interesting, talking about the pilot and the radar operator, these guys were a team. They ate together, drank together, slept together, you know, the whole nine yards. And a radar operator had to know his pilot. If he wanted him to turn, for instance, 2 degrees right, he had to know and calculate in his mind, okay, I know my pilot, he's aggressive, so I got to tell him 1 degree. Or my pilot's really docile, so I got to tell him 5 degrees. They came to rely on each other that way, and know the radar operator knew how the pilot would react, and he would give his signals to him accordingly. And they had to pull up to underneath of the target. And they had to identify the nationality markings. Was it a German airplane, a Japanese airplane? Once they identified what it was, then they could. They were right there. You know, it's like driving down a 4-lane highway and you look over at the guy next to you. Oh, yeah, that's a Volkswagen, you know, boom, kind of thing. They pulled up under the target, identified it, and then they would back away to about 300 yards, and then mostly they used their cannons, their 420-millimeter cannons in the belly, and all it took was, a cannon fires slower than the machine gun, so it kind of went kaboom, 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 and the target was gone if they hit it. And the shrapnel off the flying off the target would fly all around the P-61, sometimes damage it. But gosh, these guys really the way it was done, they had guts. I have the utmost admiration for what the procedures were and how they did it.
Well, I found a picture online of, because they were used in Europe, weren't they, for shooting at or trying to knock out the V-1 rockets. And I found a horrific picture of one rather badly damaged that had been a bit close when it on a successful hit on the rocket and it got caught in the blast. And 300 yards doesn't sound it sounds quite close to be behind something that's about to explode.
Yeah. Another interesting point about the P-61, you know, in Europe they were painted olive drab and gray like everything else, but in the Pacific they were painted black. And if you ever look at pictures of them in combat, and there's quite a few photographs out there, you notice that the airplanes look really beat up and the paint's peeling off of them. And that's because they were in such demand. They were just getting into the various theaters in late 43 and early 44. and there was a rush to get them out of the factory. So as a result, they did not use the familiar green chromate primer. They just sprayed black paint on them and sent them out. So as a result, when they flew through clouds or through rainstorms, the paint was just literally sandblasted off the airplanes. And you can see that in photographs on the leading edges and the cowlings. And that's a result of the effort to get the airplane out of the factory and into the theater.
Its major deployment was in the Pacific. I mean, was there anything the Japanese could do? Did they have anything that could defend against them? Because it's big, it's fast, it's really well armed.
Well, the Japanese had a number of different night fighters, as I'm sure you well know, and were a menace, you know, on the different islands in the Pacific. These guys would, you know, be up there at night. And so our guys just went out there, and they would go up high to a perch and just orbit and wait to come in, wait till they get called in to get one of these guys. Probably the most success with the airplane, arguably, I would have to say, is in the Pacific, because I think there were more squadrons and more airplanes in the Pacific. It did make the last kill of the war in the Pacific, but in Europe, shot down lots of airplanes and did a lot of damage to rail yards and trains and things like that. Those 20-millimeter cannons were just absolutely lethal.
For a plane of that size, towards the end of the war, where there's not necessarily a lot of aerial opposition, it did strike me as an ideal ground attack plane.
And interesting, most of the airplanes that went to Europe, which is where it was deployed to first, were the early A models. Some of the, again, they were painted olive drab. There were some black ones, but not a lot. Later in the war, there were black ones painted black. But they were the A models, which you can tell it's kind of got a short nose. It's sort of stubby looking at front when you look at it. Versus the B and C models, they're actually 8 inches longer forward of the nose landing gear. And actually is, in my opinion, a better-looking airplane. Our airplane, interestingly enough, is an early B. So there was a contract to build A models, and there was the A1, the A-10, the A-15, and so forth, as they made different improvements to the airplane. So now they decide they're going to build B models. They've got a lot of A parts left over. And so they efficiently used A model parts on the early B models. For instance, our airplane is a B model, but it has an A model throttle quadrant in it. And it's been I don't want to say a jigsaw puzzle, I guess, is a good way to explain it, in that our B model, it's a B1, by the way, one of the first B models, has many A parts on it. And so you got to go into the parts books and kind of decipher what you have. It's crazy. Our engine nacelles are actually A model engine nacelles, the inner wings. And some of the systems on it, like the nose gear blowdown system, again, is an A model. So the restoration has really been time-consuming, just taken us a long time. We're not rich people. We just take it day by day, and there's constant work going on. We're in the process of machining the wing spars. It'll have all new wing spars in it because of, again, the corrosion, and, you know, it sat in the jungle for 50 years and with no chromate protection or anything like that. And so there was significant corrosion on various parts of the structure. When the airplane's finished, we're estimating at this point that it will be 75% original. It's got some new skin on it here and there. It's going to have new wing spars, and I insisted on that. I hope to fly the airplane when it's finished, and I want it to be safe. I want it to last a lifetime. Not just be thrown together, if you know what I mean.
Oh, so let's get to your plane. How many are left? Yours is one of how many?
to our knowledge, there are four in the world. I'll at least say that there's four in captivity. There's our airplane, which is the oldest one. In the Air Force Museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, there is a C model that was built in 1945 after the war ended, is when it was delivered. There's one in the Smithsonian, which is also a C model. And then there's that elusive airplane in Beijing that is a late B model that was abandoned there, apparently, and left for the Chinese. And it exists in an engineering school of some sort there in Beijing.
It never fails to amaze me of things from the war, how many thousands were built, and then how many, because the war is still in living memory, but you know how many of them have just disappeared, and you know people didn't think about it at the end of the war, yet now they're so precious and there are so few remaining of these things.
When you think they built 10 or 12,000 B-17s and 10,000 or so B-25s, et cetera, et cetera. They only built, off the top of my head, 750 P-61s.
Yeah.
So it really is a rare airplane.
It is. So where did you come by yours?
Well, our airplane was assigned to the 550th Night Fighter Squadron, and they were the last squadron formed during the war. And they shipped out in August of 44 for Hollandia, New Guinea. They got there. They did not have any airplanes. And they got there around Christmas time of 44. And they didn't have any airplanes. And so they did the usual, you know, sniffing around. And somebody suggested that if they went to the island of Biak, where there was an aircraft depot, that they could just go up there and kind of commandeer an airplane and bring it back. So the squadron commander and the pilot of RP-61, his name was Logan Southfield, they go to Biak, they bum a ride on a C-47, and they go to Biak, and they, lo and behold, they spent the night there, but they, the next day, talk themselves into a P-61, which Logan Southfield flew home. That's our airplane. And his squadron commander got a P-70, which is a A-20 Havoc that's kind of converted to a night fighter. So that was the first two airplanes that the squadron got. 2 days later, they flew it home, I think, on the 6th. On the 10th, of January 1945, Southfield, who hadn't flown since August, decides that he's wants to go do a local proficiency flight with the airplane. He and his radar operator and two other individuals board the airplane. The result reports are that the two extra people, one was a transport pilot, and the other was, and it could have well been the transport pilot that flew him to Biak. We don't know that for sure. The other individual was a nurse. So, you know, all these bases had their little drinking clubs. Apparently, in the club, there was a bet that the P-61 could not outclimb the slopes of a tall mountain that is right there at the end of the runway called Mount Cyclops. It's a 7,000-foot mountain. And so the pilot says it could do it, and he's going to go out and prove this bet. Now, there's four people in this airplane. There's two seats. So these other two people were in the gunner's compartment where there was not a seat, no seat belts, no nothing. So he goes out and flies around the area for about 45 minutes, and he calls into the field and comes in and buzzes the field and pulls up over the mountain. He wasn't going fast enough. He got up about a third of the way, and he peeled off and went back and climbed for altitude and again came in over the airfield and pulled up over the mountain, and he got about halfway up the mountain. And he peeled off. He'd lost airspeed, so he peeled off. So this time he went out really high, climbed really high, dove in over the airfield. By this time, there's 10,000 people based at Hollandia Airfield, and it's like noon. They're all out watching this at this point in time. People were even, there's hospital there, people were even hanging out of the hospital windows up to their waist to try and get a glimpse of this. He comes in over the airfield, they say about 10 feet off the ground, full throttle, gets to the mountain, pulls up, gets almost near the top, and he loses airspeed. He goes to bank away a third time, and he finds that his ailerons are locked and he cannot turn the airplane. By this time, he was dangerously close to the trees, and I think the tail started to drag into the trees, and he chopped the throttles and cut the switches, and the airplane pancaked in onto a very large rock outcrop. Took down trees, the leading edges took down trees, which cushioned their fall. These trees were called ironwood trees, very dense wood, very strong. Anyway, they find themselves sitting on this mountain on top of these huge rocks. The pilot jumps out. Radar operator's got a big gash on his forehead. The other two individuals who were in the back in the gunner's compartment, one of them was a nurse, so she administers some first aid. The pilot, he's in shock, so he decides to run back to the base for help. Well, it was 7,000 feet down. It took him 8 hours to get there. He fell over a cliff and broke his back, and he also broke the bones in both of his heels. So they put him in a body cast and ultimately shipped him back to the States to a hospital. But at any rate, he avoided court-martial by doing that. So it took a search party 3 days to get to the crash site. Everybody was fine. You know, nobody, just minor injuries, actually. And so the P-61 laid there at on top of Mount Cyclops. From the crash site, you could actually see light over the top of the mountain. So he almost made it. You say, well, why were his ailerons locked? So if you're sitting in the pilot's seat, the gunner's floor is raised about a foot behind you. And just behind your right armrest, on the floor of the gunner's compartment, there's this really, I'm going to say Mickey Mouse, as a good description, short control, which is the control lock. It's spring-loaded to the locked position, and it has a little detent to keep it in the unlocked position. So here's this this nurse and this transport pilot. They're in the gunner's compartment, and you can imagine after three passes at this mountain, they were jostled around back there. Somehow, one of them kicked the control lock, and unbeknownst to the pilot, it locked the controls. So when he goes to peel away, they won't move. You know, there wasn't time enough for some real quick thinking to say, oh, the controls are locked. So anyway, so he crashed. That's the story of the crash. And the airplane laid on top of these rocks, which was a blessing, actually. They did a lot of damage to the belly, but they kept the airplane up out of the dirt and mud. And it was just above where the rainforest clouds rim around the top of the mountain. And so it stayed fairly dry. Moss grew onto the airplane and covered all of the outer skin. And, of course, moss feeds from the top, you know. So the moss basically wicked moisture away from the airframe of the airplane. And that all helped save it. We found it with air in the tires, hydraulic fluid still in the system, oil in the engines. So it was pretty well preserved.
How did you know it was there? I mean, were you looking for one?
My dad and I had an FBO operation. And we sponsored a wing of the what was then called the Commemorative Air Force at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So my dad would go to air shows with his fellow CAF members, and they were at the Cleveland, Ohio air show, and the B-29 was there, the CAF's B-29. So after the air show, these guys went out to a restaurant, and they're drinking beer and talking about World War II airplanes, and one guy says, yeah, well, I know where there's a P-40, and another guy, yeah, well, I know where there's this and that. Well, one of the B-29 crewmen by the name of Al Hoxie said, well, I know where there's a P-61. Well, that perked my dad's ears up. He knew what a P-61 was. And so he says, Al, would you give me the location of the P-61? He said, I'd like to go get that. Al Hoxie said, well, we're all members of the CAF. He said, this airplane was offered to the CAF one time before, and they declined going after it, saying there was no way to recover it. He said, in good conscience, I need to offer the airplane one more time to the CAF. And if they don't want it, then I'll send you the information. My dad said, fair enough. Well, a couple weeks later, here comes the information in the mail. The airplane was located at Hollandia, New Guinea. My dad set out to try to recover this, and before he went out to do the recovery, he wanted to make sure that he could own it. So we went to the Indonesian embassy in Washington, D.C., and spoke with the air attaché. And it took about 3 years to actually get permission to go over and even see the airplane and climb the mountain and determine if it was even worth recovering. So they actually got to see the airplane in 1984. We actually got title of the airplane in 1983. Our Air Force signed off on it, and that allowed us to go register it in our name. So anyway, Thanksgiving of 84, they go and see the airplane, and it was, of course, very much worth recovering. The question is, how do you recover it? And it's an extremely remote area of the world, to say the least.
How do you get it off something at such high altitude? Do you have to cut it up and bring it in pieces?
We had to disassemble it into sub-assemblies, you know, outer wings, inner wings, engines, and fuselage. We got the assistance of a general in the Indonesian Air Force, a retired general, who was instrumental in talking a helicopter firm into flying 3,200 miles to the crash site. And they spent a week there lifting the pieces off of the mountain. That occurred in 1988. And then we had to crate everything. And we would do this little by little as we came up with enough money to go. It cost about $30,000 for each trip over there. I think we made about four different trips. So in 1990, we finally succeeded in putting the airplane on a boat and shipped it to the U.S. We ended up having to trade a Boeing Stearman for the airplane. The Indonesians trained in the United States in 1945 when they gained their independence and became their own country. They trained at the Air Force Academy in 1945, and they flew Boeing Stearmans. So this general that helped us was one of those cadets, and he wanted a Stearman for the Indonesian Air Force Museum. So we made the cultural trade of a Stearman, which I bought at the time for $28,000. Imagine that, an airworthy Stearman. And we shipped that to them, and they gave us our export papers for the P-61, and that's all she wrote, pretty much.
That's quite a nice gesture. I didn't realize the connection with the Stearman with the Indonesians. That's I did wonder when I read that on the website why on earth they would want something like that. So it clearly is completely being rebuilt, and your aim is to get it flying again. So how difficult is it
Every rivet replaced.
I mean, how do you even source parts? Because, I mean, do you have the manuals? Because I know I was talking to some guys who were planning to build a Mosquito, and one of the problems they've been having is just, well, getting parts, especially for the Mosquito, because everything's wood and it's rotted away. But even down to plans, you know, they were struggling at the time to get hold of accurate plans. I mean, does it exist?
We have the manuals. That was the easy thing to get. And fortunately, at our Smithsonian Institute, they have a branch which has many, many, many aircraft drawings on microfilm. And so I believe there were 17 rolls of microfilm that we got of all the drawings that make up the airplane. But they're mixed. They're for A, B, and C models. And so it's really a nightmare. And they're not of the greatest quality. So we had a draftsman who was a member here at our museum, and he would go through and if we needed a part for a wing spar, for instance, he would go through and draw that off the microfilm, redraw it, you know, so we had a good legible document to look at to reference to build that part. And we have a machine shop in our museum, so we've been able to make much of the parts ourselves. We did farm out the wing spars to another firm to do that, but it's been a big project, no question.
Yeah. Are you able to source any, if I say original parts? I mean, if you're trying to keep it 75% original, I mean, that's a lot of original plan. Have you been able to find? I mean, when I talked to Andrew Panton, who has the Lancaster over here, I think their Lancaster had come without a turret, but they'd found one in Argentina, I think the story went. Because weirdly, the British had sold the Lancasters to the Argentinians, and that's why it was over there. How hard is it to sort of find parts for it?
You know, all the accessories on the engines and the hydraulic systems and all that's no-brainer. That's common parts. But airframe parts are extremely scarce. After the war, there was a handful. In 1953, most of the P-61s were cut up. There were a few bought to be converted to fire bombers, all of which over the years crashed. I think the last one crashed in 1968. But prior to us acquiring the P-61, there was an individual who was in Indonesia who was trying to steal the airplane, basically. And one of his crew had a heart attack on the mountain. And so they abandoned their bid to try and get it. They'd have never gotten it out of the country. Anyway, this guy was from California. After we got the airplane back home and we made the announcement that we have it, because we kept it all very, very quiet, I got a call from this individual, and he said, I have a tractor trailer load of P-61 spare parts that I got from one of the fire bombers. He said there's landing gear doors, there's gun bay doors, there's tail booms, there's engine mounts. He said, all of the stuff that you will need to rebuild that airplane, I have. And he said, obviously, I don't need it anymore. You're the guy that needs it. And I said, well, thank you very much. He said, I'd like to sell it to you. And I thought, well, here we go. Hold on to your shorts, you know. And I said, well, what do you want for it? He said, how's $15,000 sound? We got 568 individual airframe parts. And so we now have a tractor trailer full of spare parts for the airplane. And it was a godsend, and I my hat's off to him. His name was Jim Ricketts, is a restorer in Sacramento, California. He has no idea how he helped us out, and I thank him from the bottom of my heart.
It's amazing how sometimes things just, you know, these things turn up.
Yeah, turn up and fall into place. The one elusive thing that we've been unable to come up with is a gun turret. The P-61 turret is essentially the same turret that was on a B-29. And the B-29 had a higher priority because they figured it was going to end the war. So the P-61s, the turret was a plug-and-play type of operation. The plan was, let's send these airplanes out into the field with just the cannons, but let's put the turrets together as a kit. And when we have enough turrets, we'll send them to the field. So that's exactly what you did. They were electrically operated. All you had to do is screw the cannon plugs in. You know, everything else was in the airplane. So they'd send the turret. They'd send the gunner seat. Like I said, plug and play. Kermit Weeks in Florida has a P-61 turret that he doesn't. So far, we've been unable to get him to sell or trade that turret. And there's a museum operation out in California that also has a P-61 turret, and they have been unable to. We've been unable to talk them into selling or trading that. So they are around, and like you say, you just have to be patient and wait. I just got a B-25 tail turret fell into my lap. Out of the blue, literally out of the blue, by receiving an email. And a guy said, I've got one of those. I'll send it to you. He sent me pictures. Sure enough, is exactly what I needed. And I now have that in my hand. So you're right. What falls out of the sky, you just never know, you know?
So how close are you to finishing?
I hate to put a time frame on it. We work on the airplane every day. It sits on its wheels. It's got its tail booms installed and the stabilizer installed. We've actually got engines and cowlings installed, although the engines have to come back off and be overhauled. That's getting close to happening. So the big project is rebuilding both of the wings. The right-hand wing was intact, but the left-hand wing was sheared in half. While we made the spars for the right-hand wing, we also made the spars for the left-hand wing so that'll go faster when the time comes. So presently, we're working on the right-hand wing.
We're looking at a few more years, aren't we, then, before it's...
Yes, I would like to leave it at a few more years. You know, I would hope that it would be 2 or 3 years. I'm 66 years old, and I still want to fly that airplane. It's just too early to set a date.
I mean, this is my complete ignorance here, but you know, the only person to have flown one of those now will be some sort of World War II veteran. Chances are, how do you get somebody qualified to fly in a plane that's not been flown for so long? Is it a difficult process?
In the U.S., there is what's called a type rating for an airplane that weighs over 12,500 pounds. And the P-61 is on the list for a type rating. Problem is, who's going to give you that type rating? There is nobody that's current in the airplane that could do that. I myself have been flying the B-25 since 1979. So I've got lots of hours in it, plus I've got ratings in other heavier airplanes. Again, if you read the flight manual on the P-61, it's very, very identical to the B-25, except that it's a lot faster. It's a sleeker airplane. So I believe that I will be able to get a letter of authorization from the FAA to check myself out and fly the airplane. I'm also a flight instructor, etc. So then I would be able to check out other people in the airplane also.
Most people would be satisfied to, most people would be over the moon if they could fly, you know, the B-25, never mind, you know, I'd be happy to sit in one whether it was moving or not, but to be able to fly a number of them would be just, you know, it's out of this world. So tell me about the museum. Where can people find you?
The easiest way to find us is on the internet, on the web, And our address is www.maam.org. That will bring you to our website. We've got a very extensive website. We've got a section on there about the P-61 called the Widow's Web. And I know that there's hundreds and hundreds of people that follow the restoration. We've got hundreds of photographs on there of our restoration. And so you can see all about the museum on our website, very extensive website. Or you can come visit us in person at Reading, Pennsylvania. We're right on the Reading Regional Airport here. We've been here now for 30 years. We have a collection of 110 aircraft. It's an amazing collection. This museum started over the dream of acquiring that P-61. And I think till we got the P-61 home, we started the museum as a result of, you know, going after the airplane. Till we got it home, I think we had 19 airplanes, and it's just gone from there. We seem to get donated about an average of 3 airplanes a year. It's my full-time job. I've been doing it for 38 years. And my dad is still with us. He's directing the restoration of the airplane, although he's 96 years old at this point in time. But he's the guru for the P-61, and he's still in good health. So that's our museum. We fly to air shows around the eastern part of the U.S.
How many of your planes fly?
Well, we are operating about, I think, 11 of them.
And how many of those World War II planes are flying?
All of them.
Wow. And of all those World War II planes that you have, I mean, and I'm just looking at the list, it's fantastic. I mean, the Mitchell, those big bombs, my uncle flew on the bomber on Lancasters, and I'd love to have a flight in one of those big planes just to get the feel of what they were like. But of those planes, those that you have of the World War II vintage, which is your favourite?
The B-25.
Why is that?
Oh, I don't know. I've been flying it all these years, and it's like a Ferrari. It's a little hot rod. You can rack it around the sky like a fighter. But it's a big 30,000-pound bomber, you know. Another way you can find us, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you this. Every year, the first weekend of June, we have what's called World War II Weekend. And it's comprised of about 80 airplanes, 1,500 reenactors, all World War II airplanes, by the way. We have a big military flea market. We have entertainers. It's a 3-day event, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We have people that travel here from all over the world to attend the event. All over the world. It's amazing. This year, we'll have the 2 flying B-29s will be here. And we have 11 airplanes that will be giving airplane rides. You can book a ride on the B-29 Fifi. You can book a ride in a P-51, in an SPD Dauntless, in a C-47, in a Twin Beach, in a Curtis Helldiver, like I said, and a B-17. And that goes on every year. This will be our 28th year in doing this. We were looking for something different. Our local airport had its own air show. We couldn't compete with them, so we were looking for a different way to raise money to help fund the museum. And we came up with this World War II weekend. It is strictly dedicated to World War II. We have World War II veterans who come here and speak and sign autographs. World War II type entertainment. You owe it to yourselves to come over here and see this.
And there's a great, on your website, I think it's on the front page of your website, there's a great little video, a 2-minute video about it all. And I have to say, I watched it, just, it's brilliant. It's a really good, it really does look like a fantastic day out. Because you've got all the bases covered. If you're, you've got World War II vehicles, you've got World War II planes, you've got the reenactors, you've got, the whole dancing. Oh, it just looked like a wonderful day out. It's a, what is it, 4 days, 3 days? Fantastic few days.
So if somebody was flying in here from overseas, they would fly into Philadelphia International Airport, and we're just an hour's drive from Philadelphia. If you have an interest in that kind of thing, it's you will be in love. It's 3 days of absolutely fabulous reenactments and battles and tanks and vehicles and reenactors, and we have reenactors that represent every country that was involved in World War II.
reenactors are always great fun to watch, and usually they're very generous with their time explaining things. It sounds such a great few days. Thank you for joining me. Just to remind you, listeners, you can find the Mid-Atlantic Museum at maam.org, maam.org, and I will put links on the website. If anyone is lucky enough to be able to attend the World War II weekend there, feel free to share with us the pictures. I know I'd certainly love to see them. So with the anniversary of Dunkirk at the end of May, I thought it fitting that should be our next episode. So you have now a great excuse to watch or indeed re-watch last year's film. Don't forget, if you want to become a patron or even just see what I look like, you can find me at patreon.com/WW2podcast or click on donate on the website. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.